not exactly sure what's being maintained, but we do think that not everything has been grinded to a complete halt. We think that the primary health care continues to be an option for the Afghans in our program. Surprisingly enough, I think that yesterday we had a very much bleaker picture of what we thought was going on in the country or what was going on in our programs, but today we've gotten some reassurance that some of our programs are being maintained.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, it's time for the weekly Freak Show. Headlines and highlights for the week ending Saturday, October 20th, 2001. My name's the V-Man, and I'll be your host for this one-hour look back at the news and features not heard in or glanced over by the corporate-controlled media. On this week's program, Freak Radio's John Malkin speaks with the authors of The Better World Handbook, and later we'll hear from Christine Nadori of Doctors Without Borders on what the relief agency is doing for the people of Afghanistan. Plus, this week's Spotlight Sound. Stand by for the Weekly Freak Show, coming up next. And now headlines for the week ending Saturday, October 20th, 2001. Four peace activists with the Los Angeles Catholic Worker convicted in August for trespass at Vandenberg Air Force Base were sentenced on Monday, October 15th. Brian Buckley, Liz Wyrsch, and Mark Page were sentenced to probation and fines, while Scott Galindez was sentenced to 3 months in jail due to prior convictions. The four were part of an affinity group arrested on the base last May during a week of actions opposing the Star Wars missile defense program. Meanwhile, nine Greenpeace protesters and one journalist facing felony charges can travel home before returning to Los Angeles for trial on November 20th, a judge ruled on Tuesday. Since their arrest in July, the nine defendants have been restricted to the Central District of California. It was the latest legal battle for 15 Greenpeace activists and two journalists who were arrested near Vandenberg Air Force Base following a peaceful protest against the controversial missile defense program. All 17, including the journalists, were charged with conspiring to violate a safety zone, a Class D felony with a maximum 6-year prison term and $250,000 fine. They were also charged with entering military property without permission, a misdemeanor which carries a 6-month maximum sentence and $5,000 fine. On Tuesday, October 16th, Swedish authorities conducted early morning raids, sweeping up 17 people in different cities who were turned over to police in Gothenburg, site of this past summer's EU summit, where more than 600 people were arrested in raucous demonstrations. Three others were arrested in absentia. Authorities say that more arrests will follow both in Sweden and in Norway, Denmark, Finland, and Germany. Meanwhile, four people remain in police custody since the protests. All have been convicted but have yet to be transported to prison due to overcrowding. 19-year-old Hans Westerberg, one of three people wounded by police gunfire during the demonstrations, will be sentenced early next week. Farmers in the U.S. will be allowed to continue growing genetically engineered corn after the government decided the crop isn't a threat to human health or the environment. On Tuesday, October 16th, the Environmental Protection Agency renewed for 7 years registrations for varieties of biotech corn that produce their own toxin to kill an insect pest, a moth larva called the European corn borer. The crop is known as BT corn for a bacterium gene that it contains. Consumer groups who have opposed all genetically engineered foods say that compelling scientific studies proving that BT corn is safe do not exist. The activists contend the BT corn threatens human health with the potential to cause allergic reactions, pose unacceptable risks to butterflies such as monarchs and the endangered Karner blue, and could contaminate organic farmers' crops as well as conventional non-GE foods. Activists from around Canada converged on Toronto's financial district early on the morning of Tuesday, October 16th, to protest growing poverty in the country and around the world by attempting to temporarily shut down the country's financial center. The confrontational protests began before daybreak and disrupted some activity on Toronto's Bay Street and lasted several hours before marchers joined other street parties and rallies. The protests nearly coincided with an announcement by Ontario Premier Mike Harris that he will step down as soon as his Progressive Conservative Party can choose a new leader. Canadian activists have long criticized Harris for instituting policies that have allowed poverty to grow exponentially in Canada. Tuesday's protest was the kickoff of the fall campaign of economic disruption by the Ontario Common Front, a coalition of over 75 anti-poverty and social justice organizations. Meanwhile, Canadian Finance Minister Paul Martin announced on Wednesday, October 17th, that Ottawa will be hosting a meeting of the G20 economic nations on the weekend of November 16th through 18th. The Monetary and Finance Division of the International Monetary Fund and the Development Division of the World Bank were invited to this event and have confirmed they will attend, as their planned meetings scheduled for late September in Washington, D.C., were canceled amid security concerns. In the wake of September 11th, it is more vital than ever that we continue our work on the world stage, Martin said of the G20 meetings. Many in the global justice movement agree with this sentiment and have called for organized resistance on these days. In the forefront, though, is November 9th, when the World Trade Organization will meet in Doha, Qatar, an isolated Persian Gulf dictatorship which has outlawed public protest. People across the globe are localizing efforts to stop the day-to-day impact of the WTO's free trade agenda. Protests on these days will focus community efforts against environmental racism, skyrocketing incarceration, attacks on immigrant rights, housing displacement, low wages, lousy working conditions, and cuts in social services. And finally, approximately 100 anti-war protesters gathered in Sacramento, California on Wednesday, October 17th, to greet U.S. President G.W. Bush, who was there to address elite members of the business lobby. Police barricaded a sizable radius surrounding Memorial Auditorium, forcing the demonstrators to congregate on successive corners several blocks away, denying them the right to express dissent within a reasonable distance of the presidential festivities. In addition to contesting U.S. aggressions against the people of Afghanistan, activists also decried Bush's proposed free trade agenda. Formerly known as Fast Track, this bill effectively writes Congress out of the trade negotiating process, allowing the president and selected officials to shape far-reaching agreements, such as the Free Trade Area of the Americas, with only a quick congressional nod of consent. After repeated failure to secure the extended presidential powers throughout the Clinton years, the bill finally passed by a 26-13 vote in the House Ways and Means Committee on October 9th. This far-reaching legislation will likely face a full vote in the House of Representatives next week, possibly paving the way to Senate consideration shortly thereafter. In the only confirmed arrest at Wednesday's protest, Sacramento police seized a woman who had allegedly crossed the street to converse calmly with her flag-waving pro-war adversaries gathered across the road. And those were headlines for the week ending Saturday, October 20th, 2001. Ellis Jones, Ross Henfler, and Brett Johnson are passionate, progressive University of Colorado professors who banded together to research and write The Better World Handbook, a thorough, engaging guide to everyday activism which is published by New Society Publishers. Divided into three major sections, Building a Better World, The Seven Foundations of a Better World, and Actions for a Better World, The Better World Handbook focuses on the most practical, effective actions individuals can take to make a positive difference in the world. Freak Radio's John Malkin recently spoke with two of the authors, Ellis Jones and Ross Henfler.
Your book covers a real gamut of activities that people can engage in to help to create a better world, from building stronger personal relationships to making socially responsible investments. And there's even an alternative media guide. And I notice in a chapter on war, the section opens with the sentence, "We live in the age of total war." You wrote this book before the September 11th attacks on the East Coast of the United States and before the U.S. response by attacking Afghanistan. It seems particularly poignant, this section on war in your book.
Well, We try not to write the book so much towards the typical activist areas that people think of, like peace activism or environmentalism, but we did include in the foundations a section on comprehensive peace. We've created these 7 foundations of a better world, and comprehensive peace is the second one. And we talk about living in the age of total war, and that being this idea that war has become even more democratized than it ever has been before, that civilians are fair targets, proper targets, and sometimes even the main targets of warfare. In the past, while war has always been brutal and awful, now it's just no holds barred. The one side just wins and the other side surrenders. It's almost like you need to crush your enemies until they're no more. We've seen the aftermath of warfare in places like Iraq, where, you know, they're still being bombed 10 years later, and a 500,000 children or so have died because of the sanctions. That's where we're coming at from this idea of the age of total war, and the current situation in Afghanistan, I think, is another example of that.
You've written a whole book on recommendations about what people can do to alleviate suffering and to make a better world. I wonder if you have some bit of advice for the present moment in terms of this attack that happened in New York and people feeling afraid. There's now been anthrax apparently being sent in the mails in the United States, and the retributive attack upon the people of Afghanistan. Are there one or two or three things that you think are substantial actions that people can take?
There are actually, a number of actions that people can take in this case. First of all, though, I'd like to preface the actions by saying, with the attacks of September 11th and the subsequent retribution by the United States, these are incredibly large problems that have detailed history, and that we're kind of seeing the end result of a number of chains of action and reaction. So I'd like to emphasize that there really is no one quick fix that a person can use to kind of resolve these problems in a final sense. Having said that, I think there are a number of things that people should think about, both in the short term and the long term. The first and foremost being that I think people need to access alternative sources of media. The mainstream media has been completely taken over by these incidents, and in some sense, rightly so, but in another sense, there is an aspect of sensationalism playing on people's fears. And really, as much as the media has now focused on these events, we're not seeing that kind of long-term analysis of where we have come from and why we are here and what are the alternatives for the future that we can build and who is out there that's already been working on this. So I would say the first recommendation is to go out, find these alternative sources of media. Your program, for example, being one of them, with micro radio around the country, alternative radio, community radio. There are a number of alternative magazines and publications out there that are great sources, and now the internet holds a number of sources as well. Really, for people to first inform themselves so that they understand fully both the ramifications of this event and the historic background behind it, so that they can make some educated choices about what's really going on. Second, I would recommend that people understand the relationship between these events and U.S. foreign policy, international relations, and the way the defense industry works today, that they realize that there are groups that exist that have been working on these issues for some time, like the Center for Defense Information or the War Resisters League. There's just a number of groups out there, and to get in touch with these groups, both to find out information from them, but also to find out actions that they can specifically take to help the U.S. change its long-term policies and help set up a kind of global vision so that these types of incidents don't happen in the world. The other thing is, once a listener is informed or feels like they have something to work with, to really start participating, there's got to be a real shift from being simply an information consumer and becoming interactive, becoming an information producer, exchanging that information online, letters to the editor, letters to your representatives, to get them to kind of speak to these issues one-on-one with you. For people that are really committed around issues like this, and this is more for the long term, but I would suggest in our book we have listed a number, in the travel chapter, a number of reality tours and home exchanges where people might, in this situation, consider spending some time in some of the regions that are relevant to our situation now in the Middle East, and really get to know the people there, and through the people themselves, understand some more sides to this issue, because we really are, with our U.S. media, only getting one side of what is going on. And finally, I'd like to say a number of suggestions I've seen on the television, especially right after the incident, had to do with donating blood to blood banks. And there was just such a slew of people that actually rallied around this. And this is something in sociology that we've understood for a long time, that when disasters strike, that people really do mobilize, and you get to see what caring people in action can do when they're sparked to do that. So many people came to the blood banks that a number of people were turned away. People had to make appointments weeks in advance. I would say, instead of, for those people who are interested in doing something like that, instead of just reacting to this particular situation and giving blood to help the victims of the tragedy, like, if those same people would now come out and, say, make a commitment to giving blood once a month or once every couple months, perhaps for the next year or more. The blood banks in the U.S. have always been teetering on the edge of crisis, and consistently do so from year to year because people don't mobilize around events like this for the long term. There is only a short-term reaction. So those are one, four, or five little things that I think people can get started with.
I'm speaking with Ellis Jones and Ross Henfler, who are two of the four authors of the Better World Handbook, From Good Intentions to Everyday Actions. In your book, you describe a cycle of cynicism and apathy that is very prevalent in the United States, and you discuss the possibility of breaking out of that cycle with the creation of a more hopeful cycle. I'd like you to talk about that.
I think we've really pinpointed at least what we believe to be one of the key, if not the key issue in the U.S. that stops people from acting on their values, and that is this kind of cycle of cynicism. We strongly believe that the reason people are so cynical in today's society, and we would define them as such, in that they no longer are willing to, for the most part, take action on the social problems that they see in the world, is in large part due to the fact that our society, our culture, has evolved to manufacture cynicism within people. Just a quick example, most of the people in the U.S. nowadays get the majority of their information about what goes on in the world through television. When people are watching the news, for example, they are bombarded with information and images and stories, most of them in just little tiny sound bites. And in fact, most of them, because the news media has to compete with programs that are entertainment-based, they tend to have to lay up these sensational aspects of what goes on. And often those sensational aspects are also negative aspects. So you get highlights for things like crime and disaster and violence that takes place in the world. And with this kind of flood of negative imagery and this sea of information, people quickly become lost, especially in the cases that when some particular social problem is presented, whether it be people starving in East Africa or a natural disaster in Central America, the media hasn't been very good historically about providing people with avenues for action, because when most people watch those clips, immediately they feel drawn to the fact that this is a problem and that they would like to do something to help. But over and over again, once the media moves on from that particular problem to the sports or the stock market, and they leave people kind of hanging without an avenue for action, people begin to learn that perhaps there is no action that they can take. There are no actions being offered that they can take. And so there's kind of a hopelessness that's built up, or a sense of disempowerment. The events that take place on the TV begin to kind of take on a slightly unreal quality for people. To break this, I think the key really is to bring action back into the equation, to have people understand that their own lives are connected with these events that go on in the world, for people to really take responsibility for their impact as good, caring people upon the world, and to understand that once you are able to take responsibility for that and you start on the road to seeking out quality information about what is going on in the world and discovering kind of practical opportunities for you to take action, even if it is a small action, it's something, and that means that you are actually moving forward, you're acting on your values, and at the same time you're recognizing that you yourself can't take on the burdens of the world on your shoulders, but you are doing your part. You are kind of taking responsibility for your role, and you're creating the better world from where you stand in the world. With this kind of a cycle, people, instead of turning off, instead of becoming cynical, the cycle of action motivates people to seek more information, to create more powerful action, to make more and more of a difference in the world.
This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and I'm speaking with Alice Jones and Ross Henfler, two of the authors of The Better World Handbook. In your book, The Better World Handbook, you lay out seven foundations for a better world, and you've mentioned one of them, comprehensive peace, and I'd like you to mention the other ones. I want you to talk about one of them in particular, deep democracy. I want to hear what that is in a little detail and hear from you how far away you think that we are from that.
Whenever you start trying to lay out a vision of a better world, it can get really complicated. So we really struggled with how can we create a vision for this world that is very inclusive and encompasses all the struggles that we have to meet and all the hopes that we have. So we came up with these seven. And the first one is economic fairness. The second one is comprehensive peace. Then ecological sustainability, deep democracy, social justice, a culture of simplicity, and revitalized community. And in each of these sections in the book, we kind of outline what are the barriers to realizing these foundations, and then we give a few examples of how people are already in action trying to turn it around. The Deep Democracy Foundation is really central to our vision of a better world, and what we've written is that deep democracy is a world built on deep democracy would empower citizens to participate in shaping their futures every day, not just on election day, provide broad access to quality information, and democratize our most powerful institutions. You know, we would love to see everyone get involved, and like we say, not just on election day. We've got an election coming up here in Boulder soon, and since it's not a congressional election, it's not a presidential election, a lot of people won't turn out and vote. We point out in the book how voter turnout has fallen consistently for such a long time. People are really getting fed up with our politics. Some of the barriers that people are facing are, you know, they don't have the money to get involved, they don't have access to good information, and really the media has such a tight control on the information that gets out there and which candidates get covered and how they get covered that it can be very frustrating. So what we're calling for is creating a system that's based on open and honest politics. We want to democratize the media, and we really want civic participation in a number of levels, not just voting. We would really love to see third parties have more access to the media. So we'd really like to see the people get more control over the airwaves. We own them, you know, so we should be able to say if our democracy is so important to us, we should be able to give candidates a reasonable amount of television time, which means they wouldn't have to raise so much money and that a variety of candidates could get their viewpoints out there. So, you know, right now, I feel like we're pretty far from a democracy, and unfortunately the irony of the present situation is that in supposedly defending our freedoms out there, Congress will very likely pass legislation that will limit our freedoms in terms of providing law enforcement more access, making it easier for law enforcement to detain, search people, and whatnot.
That was Ellis Jones and Ross Hempler speaking with Freak Radio's John Malkin. For more information about the book, visit their website, www.betterworldhandbook.com.
It's been an exciting couple of months with the new administration there. Everything seems to be a lot like it was before, only a little sped up. You know, the same things are happening, only a little more so. from Guatemala to Korea, to the tunnels beneath Hanoi, from Tulsa to El Chorizo, fat man to little boy. We fought them in Nicaragua and upon the Cuban shore, killed Gaddafi's daughter. See what the fatwas got in store. We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. Oh, say, can you see? From Kabul to Khartoum, where Allah's martyrs bled, to the Iraqi desert, 200,000 people dead. We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. Oh, say, can you see? Assassins to Argentina's dirty war. From Arizona to Nevada, we'll nuke our way to heaven's door. We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. Oh, say, can you see? We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. Oh, say, can you see?
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM, in Santa Cruz, California, you're tuned to the Weekly Freak Show on Studio X, webcasting in Seattle, Washington at www.microradio.net/Studio X. Please have a pen and paper ready to take down our contact information at the end of this 1 hour broadcast. That was David Rovix with this week's Spotlight Sound, from Kabul to Khartoum, available through his website, davidrovix.com. For over 30 years, some 15,000 doctors have delivered emergency aid to victims of armed conflict, epidemics, and natural and man-made disasters, and to others who lack health care due to social or geographical isolation. Known as Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, they have been at the forefront of emergency health care to the victims of natural disaster and war in over 80 countries. In many remote and volatile places, Doctors Without Borders is the only international presence. Teams travel by boat, car, plane, pack horse, and on foot to bring relief wherever it is needed. The privately owned nonprofit was the first non-governmental organization to both provide emergency medical assistance and publicly bear witness to the plight of the populations they served. Its volunteers protest violations of humanitarian law on behalf of populations who have no voice and bring the concerns of their patients to public forums such as the United Nations, governments, and the media. I spoke with Christine Nadori, Medical Program Director of Doctors Without Borders in New York City. We begin with a discussion of the organization's work.
I want to talk about the situation in Afghanistan, but first, can you give our listeners just a little idea of the importance of the kind of work you do? Doctors Without Borders steps in where governments fail to provide medical aid, and as I mentioned, Doctors Without Borders operates in more than 80 countries, so I'm curious how the organization is set up, what sort of medical relief Doctors Without Borders provides, and to what extent are you able to make a difference in the lives of refugees and other displaced people?
Essentially, we're an independent humanitarian aid organization that focuses mainly on medical intervention. So normally what we're bringing people on the field is medical relief. So
So essentially, we are stepping in a time, in a crisis time, a time of crisis, and that could mean many things. It can mean war, refugee crisis, or internally displaced crisis. It could also mean an epidemic of incredibly big proportion that we can respond to medically. It could also mean victims of natural disasters. We also work with excluded populations. People, due to their race or political affiliation sometimes, or religion, are excluded from health care and therefore are suffering enormously. So these are the kind of crisis that we normally respond to. A lot of times we are dealing with populations who are in movement, people who are having to leave their homes because there's something very violent or aggressive going on around them, or because they've exhausted a lot of their resources to survive. The situation that we're facing in many countries all over the world today, a lot of the contexts that we are working in are people on the move like that. And over the years, we've tried to address those problems, not only in a medical sense, but we'll look past the medical in a lot of cases and build shelter if that's what's needed to protect people from the environment, therefore giving them less medical problems, for instance, or clean water can be an activity that we do, or providing people with good water and sanitation and latrines and so on. So that's the technical aspect of what we do when we go on the field, but there is also speaking out, or let's say the témoignage, which is a French word that means actually witnessing, and that doesn't always mean making a lot of noise or big statements. It's essentially standing beside the population in need and acknowledging their plight through our presence there, and also being a non-aggressive actor in a very aggressive environment, someone who is not trying to manipulate, hurt, or kill, or maim, or rape, etc., is a strong element in a chaotic arena. So a lot of times we are offering that to populations. Sometimes we will speak to different forms about what these populations are living medically. Normally we talk about medical conditions that they're suffering from, and that's a pretty good indication a lot of times of what people are living. I'm rambling.
It's fine. You're doing great. This sounds like dangerous work, though. I'm wondering how populations treat the doctors and medical professional staff that come into their countries. How do governments treat the doctors?
Right to humanitarian assistance in times of conflict is a human right, in a sense. We're not always welcome with wide open arms, but generally when the big parts of the population are suffering, even rebel governments like to know that there is some relief for them, even if they can't provide it. We do go into a very aggressive settings at times, and we do have to play the international humanitarian law card on a few occasions to open doors, to, you know, allow us to be in a context or in a situation, no matter how precarious it is. It's a balance. We're thinking of security of our teams on the field as well as the plight of the population, and decisions are made to go into a certain setting when a lot of, let's say, a lot of these things have been evaluated and looked at. One has been weighed against the other, in a sense. There are some settings that we just cannot go into, that we know that, you know, systematically there will be problems if we do go, whether it be an expatriate staff or a volunteer staff being killed, or our staff being targeted on a regular basis, or a large part of our aid being diverted, so on. We do put those in the balance, too, when we decide to go into somewhere. But generally, we are providing a very much needed medical service. And the act of treating a population, of treating a person, legitimizes our presence in a lot of places where you would not imagine that we should be or could be, actually. People have a very good understanding that we're there to treat people, and that we are not taking sides, and that we are impartial. That's something that we do. We do talk about a lot when we do go into a country. We negotiate with the authorities who are controlling the areas that we're going into, and we also prove what we're there to do in terms of, you know, delivering medical assistance to people and saving lives to a certain extent, and alleviating suffering, and that also speaks for itself.
I think by now our listeners here are probably pretty familiar with the tragic events of September 11th. We're now about 5 weeks into the rescue effort and the cleanup there in New York City. Right. What role has Doctors Without Borders been fulfilling in this effort?
In New York City itself, It was an incredible thing to see the reactions of the New Yorkers to this crisis. You know, people were really flocking to the site, I think, to try to offer their help and assistance. And the city benefited from a very good, logistically sound reaction to the events. MSF, of course, Doctors Without Borders, has expertise in this arena, but we did see that a lot of things were being taken care of. in a proper way. The office staff here in New York actually did do a lot of volunteer work with the family crisis centers that were set up around this to register people who needed assistance right now due to this crisis. So I think that generally we reacted like a lot of people did on a volunteer basis. You know, people who had the time and could went to help out in the efforts of not necessarily the cleanup, but more the support to the families who were coming in to register possibly dead loved ones and so on. That was on the one hand on an individual basis. On another basis, we looked to see, well, where could our expertise come into play since there is a good response in terms of, an adequate response in terms of the immediate emergency on a medical side. So what we did was call some of our mental health specialists in from Holland who have a lot of experience in dealing with mass trauma with different approaches as we have started to more and more bring mental health at the onset of emergencies and in the work that we're doing overseas and in different conflicts. We thought that these people would be able to be beneficial to the mental health providers of the city. So two of them came and they worked very closely with organizations that were doing mass debriefings for staff that had lived something quite horrendous, having lost people, you know, staff of different groups or businesses that were very close to the events, you know, different hospitals, medical professionals that had been on standby waiting for patients that never came and so on. So a lot of that created problems in terms of coping with this big crisis. So we supported the mental health groups to a certain extent that went into these settings. We chose one in particular that was being requested quite a bit from all kinds of institutions here in New York to come and do mass debriefings or staff debriefings. So we chose to support them in their work and to be their sounding board to a certain extent. That was on the one hand. And we did get calls also from different hospitals in the city who requested our counselors to go to them directly and do counseling with them. That's one of the ways that we felt maybe possibly our expertise could be useful to the city.
Moving now to Afghanistan, after a decade-long war with the former Soviet Union, in which more than 1 million people were killed, Afghanistan has become the site of the greatest crisis in hunger and refugee displacement in the world. 40% of the buildings there are destroyed. There's over 4 million orphans, and about 25% of children die before age 5. After 4 years of a relentless drought, millions have fled to Pakistan, Iran, and surrounding countries in search of food. To what degree was Doctors Without Borders operating there before September 11th, and what effect did the terrorist events here have on your organization's work in Afghanistan?
We have a very long and involved history with that country in terms of having been there for 20 years. Our organization has been in existence for 30, and 20 of those years we spent them in that country to varying degrees, but consistently. So it started, you know, we went in at the time of the Russian occupation or when the Russians were trying to take that country over. We were working at that time. And then once the Russians actually pulled out and the ensuing civil conflicts arose and continued for over 10 years, we maintained our presence in that country. We were very involved at many levels, essentially doing primary health care. There's a huge problem with infrastructure in that country because it has been 20 years of war. A lot of things have been destroyed and the education is almost nil at this point. So essentially we were providing a lot of primary health care service type of programs. And we've always had a very strong theme of access for women. We've always tried to advocate for the access to women to our programs. More recently, Afghanistan, as a lot of people know here in the United States, I think people are very well read on the issues concerning Afghanistan these days. More recently, they've been living a drought for about 3 years. So what the civil war that had been progressively bringing them to their knees, the drought has essentially push them over the edge, and it has been very difficult for them. People always ask me, why is it that they've been able to live all this time with the civil war, and all of a sudden, you know, a drought is going to make them have major problems and make them move, make them displace themselves. And I like to always think, or not like, but I think that the Afghans are very resourceful people, and they have been in the country at war for 20 years, and they have coping mechanisms. A lot of time, their crops will be used as not only to make them survive nutritionally, but to pay a price to the warring factions in the region. Maybe it'll pay a commander off so that they won't have to give their son to the effort. There's all these coping mechanisms that happen with food, but anyhow, these people have lost all coping mechanisms. So this was even before September 11th. There had been a lot of internal displacement within the country, people looking for food because they had completely lost their coping mechanisms. Some had even gone as far as seeking refuge in Pakistan and Iran. And these two countries were becoming not so welcoming anymore. They had taken in millions over the conflict with the Russians and the ensuing civil war. They had taken a lot of people in and were less welcoming to the new Afghans who were starting to flood out because of the civil war and the drought effect. We were looking at a bad situation before September 11th. So we were there in big numbers. We had 70 international volunteers working there in the field, despite the problems that we can have working in that country. We had 70 people and over 400 or 500 staff, national staff, running programs in probably every big city, from Faizabad in the Northern Alliance to Mazar-i-Sharif in the north and Herat in the west and Kandahar in the south, also Kabul, and etc. So what happened September 11th, obviously the domestic focus very quickly turned to the international scene and the gaze stopped itself very pointedly on Afghanistan, and that created a lot of pressure within that country. And the authorities there told us, we can no longer ensure your security, there's a lot of rogue elements here and so on. So that's pushed us to leave. So we had to pull out our international staff. So right now, at a time where Afghanistan really needs humanitarian assistance, we are unable to monitor and to fully implement our programs on the field. Although pulling out 70 international staff doesn't mean a total end of our programs, there has been maintained contact with national staff on the field, and we've been able to get some food supplies and also some medical supplies in to continue the programs, and they have been continuing to a certain degree, so not all is lost yet. But let's say that the humanitarian space for action is getting smaller every day. That's where we're at today. We still have international staff and full capacity in the Northern Alliance region, which is in the northeast part, because it's non-Taliban controlled and there's less rogue elements, as we say. We've been able to ensure security of our international staff. Therefore, along with our national staff, we are maintaining our programs and we are able to maintain a presence there.
For nearly 2 weeks now, U.S.-led airstrikes have been raining down missile strikes on Afghanistan, a country roughly the size of Texas. In addition to the bombs, the U.S. Air Force pilots have been also dropping about 38,000 daily food rations and medicines in what is being called humanitarian action. Mm-hmm. Now, the Geneva Convention defines humanitarian action as neutral, independent, and impartial. Why is this an ineffective means for providing aid, and how does this mixing of roles between the military operations and aid activities undermine your work, undermine independent, non-governmental humanitarian assistance?
Those are really hard questions, but they're the questions that are preoccupying us the most at this point. As you know, as you probably or may know at this point, the overland efforts of delivering food were somewhat halted by the airstrikes. Essentially, that's not a good thing, but we do understand the response that the U.S. and the coalition have decided to have according to these attacks on September 11th. That's a one thing. Completely separate from that, you're asking me a question regarding the food droppings, I believe, and why is that inefficient? Well, we ask ourselves the question, actually, is it efficient? What worries me the most, actually, as someone who's worked in the field and who has had to walk that tightrope, actually, of going into a setting that was highly politically charged, trying to go in based on the fact that I am a neutral actor and I'm going to solely provide humanitarian assistance in terms of medical aid to a population. That's a very heavy card to play. I mean, you really need to understand or be able to explain that you are neutral, you are humanitarian assistance, and there is a right for this population to receive humanitarian assistance. Anything that kind of blurs those lines becomes problematic. The next time you want to go into that setting, you know, you are going to be possibly perceived as a political actor, therefore putting yourself at risk and especially your action at risk. And who is that going to not benefit in the end? Of course, the population. Now, whether the airdroppings has done all this, we're not sure. I think that we would like these practices to be reconsidered and to be rethought, in a sense, in the light of the possible future implications and the blurring of like what we say is military and humanitarian lines, it might make our overland re-entry quite difficult after, or anyways, perceived differently than what we would need them to be perceived as. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. It brought up something, though. I mean, George Bush has stated time and time again since September 11th that you're either with us or with the terrorists, that there's no neutrality in this conflict, and that puts you in kind of a dangerous position as, you know, being a neutral party. How do you feel about all this?
This is not it's not a new problem. This is not the first time that this has happened. There has been a mixing of military and humanitarian assistance. We do firmly believe at MSF that there is a big risk to the population to continue to engage in that kind of action. And we think that it's going to reduce the humanitarian space. I do not think that today we are, as a humanitarian agency, against the political actions that are being undertaken today. Therefore, we are standing our neutral ground. And I don't think that having or requesting that military action remains very clearly defined and humanitarian action remains clearly defined for future action. I don't think that's being unneutral. And I think that it may have been perceived that our organization is against the military action, but we do have an understanding of the international law and the right to self-defense and the actions that are going on here today. We do want to ensure, though, that there is a room for humanitarian assistance and that this fundamental right is respected in this very chaotic context, and that the rights of civilians, of course, are respected. Of course, sometimes it sounds like a very intellectual conversation, but it does have very lofty ideals, but it does have direct implications when we do have to return, or when we need to return on the field with the massive food aid that needs to be distributed there, and we're going to need to monitor it properly. And it's going to have to go to, first of all, the very vulnerable groups that we've had to identify by means of the tools that we usually use, as opposed to just anyone who happens to pick up a bag on the ground. Targeting the proper or the right, the most needy populations has always been a focus of ours, because we do go in with big means at times, but it's not a lot when you consider the kind of huge problem that we're facing today. So we want to kind of try to safeguard that humanitarian space for future involvement. And again, I don't think that means being non-neutral.
Now, these issues were portrayed or conveyed to a joint hearing of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and a Congressional Subcommittee on Near Eastern and South Asian Affairs recently on October 10th by Doctors Without Borders U.S. Director Nicholas D. Torrente. What were his concerns brought up, and how did these politicians respond?
Well, first of all, I think it was really good to have the opportunity to talk there and to say what we thought was the most important thing to say. I think that Nicholas focused on the obvious plight of the Afghan people pre-September 11th, and this is something that the Senate was very much aware of also. I think that's not a new issue. Maybe that there's a lot more focus on this population and this conflict today because of what's happened on September 11th, but I think that the American government has always been very responsive to the humanitarian needs of Afghanistan. So it was not surprising that we did get this space to talk about what was most important for us. So we discussed this, we reiterated what our vision was of what the plight was, since we are very present in that country. We did express the fact that we do want to go back in as soon as possible. We also did express the fact that we wanted to safeguard our neutrality in action and humanitarian assistance. I think that it was well received. I think we had come across very clearly or blatantly in messages that we had put out in terms of being against the airdrops, the food drops. So it gave us a forum to really communicate with the American government on what exactly we were worried about with that action, that blurring of military and humanitarian lines. And essentially, it gave us a forum to discuss it. And that's basically what we focused on, in fact. We also focused a little bit on the fact that we felt, you know, the Afghan people today had very little choices. Essentially, they were living in a very bad situation with not only internal conflict, but now also airstrikes, and that the borders were essentially closed, so they could not seek refuge. This is a preoccupation. The fact that they have no choice to seek asylum or seek refuge in another country today, and for that reason, we have been seeing massive internal displacements in that country. And displacement actually weakens an already very weakened population. this is problematic. These are the things that we discussed. And I think that there were people listening in the Senate. Of course they were, or else they wouldn't have asked us to come.
This week, several compounds of Doctors Without Borders in Afghanistan were looted. The compounds in the cities of Mazar-e-Sharif and Kandahar, which are Taliban strongholds, and a scene basically of intense battles right now. In fact, I heard Mazar-e-Sharif has been changing hands back and forth over the week. Can you talk about the significance of the supplies that were raided and how this is going to affect the civilian population in that region?
Well, Mazar-e-Sharif is a host and was host to a large amount of people who had congregated around that town. As I was describing before, this situation of drought adding itself to the conflict made people lose their coping mechanisms, and the people in and around Mazar-e-Sharif are those very people. They're coming from the west part, which is very desert-like, and normally enjoys some kind of crop, but it's always the first to suffer when there is not enough rain and so on. So people from the northwest had moved towards the city to get assistance. Some people from the east also moved towards the city, and a little bit south of Mazar moved towards the city. So you had a certain amount of a population around Mazar-e-Sharif who were setting up in camps, essentially. So that means a lot of people huddled together, in a sense, in a very close proximity to each other. MSF had started to work in those camps with other organizations to provide things like shelter, water and sanitation, and food. We were looking at winter approaching, so we were focusing a lot on shelter. Another thing that we're doing there is providing primary health care. In the camps, we were functioning under a mobile clinic that was going from camp to camp. Let's say there's more than one camp. There's quite a few settlements. So we were operating primary health care units that were mobile. For the rest of that region in general, we were doing primary health care and supporting primary health care clinics through drug donation and occasional supervision. So that starts to constitute a whole network of people getting assisted through medical care, having an option for treatment. Also, you know, it meant that we knew people, the medical professionals who were manning these clinics, we know them, and we communicate with them. We communicate with them on a normal level through supervision, and we also communicate them through statistics. They will be showing us on a regular basis what they're seeing as pathologies. Therefore, we can follow epidemiologically what's going on. We know in advance if there's cholera in a region, and we can react to it. We know in advance, or let's say we know when it's happening, when there's a measles epidemic, therefore we can react to it. We'll know if there's a scurvy or any kind of problem that we can assist them with. So what's going on right now is our lack of presence kind of destroys that network of surveillance in the country or in that region. What it also does, and to get to the lootings, it causes insecurity that may make our national staff not want to reach out to as many clinics as they normally are reaching out to right now with drugs and with daily or on a weekly supervision type of contact. We were running also supplementary and therapeutic feeding centers in some of those camps, meaning that we were feeding the moderately malnourished and also having a program set up for severely malnourished. So today, due to the looting, we're not exactly sure what's being maintained, but we do think that not everything has been grinded to a complete halt. We think that the primary health care continues to be an option for the Afghans in our programs. Surprisingly enough, I think that yesterday we had a very much bleaker picture of what we thought was going on in the country or what was going on in our programs, but today we've gotten some reassurance that some of our programs are being maintained. Because despite the fact that we were not there in Mazar-e-Sharif, for instance, as an international presence, we had been able to get at least 9 months of drugs across the border and into our program. So I think that these things are continuing to a certain extent. But I really need to stress the fact that we need a more secure situation to go in there and to really assess the situation. We're working in it kind of blindly right now and hoping that most of our programs are still running, but knowing that they're probably not. So the space for action, the space for humanitarian assistance is getting smaller and smaller every day in this crisis.
Yeah.
And it should actually be becoming bigger and bigger, you know, if you're really relating it to the needs.
You mentioned earlier that winter there is fast approaching. Can you give us an idea of the severity of winter in this region?
This is a hilly region. When I was there in 1995, 1996, and also again in 2000. And you're in the foothills. Many parts of the country, you're in the foothills of one mountain range or another. So you do get snow, and it is quite cold. So there needs to be heating and so on. As you're moving towards the west, it gets warmer and warmer. Mazar-e Sharif, where there is a big group of people, normally was not as cold. But in the recent years, it has, you know, the temperatures are dipping a little bit lower and lower for some reason. And last year, we unfortunately saw for the first time people dying of cold and exposure in camps around Mazar-e Sharif or in that town. That's very preoccupying. Assistance in a cold country is very different than assistance in a warm country. You need to bring in shelter, you need to bring in fuels, you need to bring in isolants. People need to be well fed, people need to have enough kilocalories to keep them warm. It's not a time for the temperature to dip. I'd say in an already very kind of impoverished and weakened population. So it's preoccupying to us.
What's the worst-case scenario right now in this crisis, and what are the biggest problems that you're seeing medically?
Malnutrition was probably one of the top of the list, I would say. Nutrition. People are not going to have enough to eat. And, you know, exposure to violence. I think that there's not only the airstrikes going on, but there always had been internal conflict. And I think that that's heating up more. As far as I've been told, the airstrikes have been targeted to a certain extent, so... But that doesn't stop the internal conflicts also that are going on. They've got, like I said, a chaotic environment to be living in right now. Those are big problems. And the fact that we will not be able to reach them is a huge, huge problem, this lack of space. There needs to be an understanding by all the powers in this conflict that civilians need to be protected in this.
I really appreciate you taking the time this morning to speak with us. I'm speaking with Christine Nadori. She is a medical program officer at Doctors Without Borders in New York City. Christine, final question. What can we do here? Are there ways people can contribute to relief efforts besides sending money?
Following the situation, being aware of that.
Staying informed.
Staying informed. I think that if we are informed of the situation, then we will naturally give it the energy or the thought that it requires. And it might help you to react in certain times differently. An understanding of what's going on might make you think differently of your neighbor, let's say, or the person who is living next to you who doesn't come from a country that you know very well. Or I think that if there's something we can do here in our own country here is to remain open-minded to people of different nationalities and also to recognize their plight in a sense. It's incredible, I think, the people that are walking in our streets who have lived this very situation, who have been populations very much in danger. I think we now have a better understanding of what that is also, and I think that we need to really try to reach out to one another on those levels, but to be aware of what's going on in this conflict and to be aware of the different elements that impact on this conflict.
And if people do want to send money, how can they do that?
This is not something I'm very knowledgeable about, but I'm sure that if you go on the website, which is www.doctorswithoutborders.org, I'm sure that there's information there that will allow you to, you know, navigate your way through that, if it's money that you want to give.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening. The Weekly Freak Show is produced live in the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, and can also be heard on the show Suppressed Truths on KZUU 90.7 FM in Pullman, Washington. The interviews featured in this program are only a sample of the fine shows each week on Freak Radio. To hear it all 24 hours a day, listen online at www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. For questions and comments, send email to FRSC@microradio.net. That's FRSC@microradio.net. Or snail mail to P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project and Independent Media Centers for distribution. Our theme music was arranged and performed by Neil Norman and his Cosmic Orchestra. For John Malkin and everyone here at Freak Radio. My name's the V-Man, and that's a wrap.